This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Kenneth Frederick Rice III.
Vernon Allen Richard.
Claude Daniel.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Today in New York, Washington, Pennsylvania, and across the nation, Americans mark the second anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
We gather in sorrow, in remembrance, in our vigilance to never forget the magnitude of what happened here 2 years ago, and in collective resolve to ensure that those who died did not do so in vain.
Leo Arthur Roberts.
And my grandmother, Arcea Castillo. We love you.
People who live in freedom have something to live for, something to fight for, and even something to die for.
Donald Walter Robertson, Jr.
Katharina Robertson.
We remember lives lost. We remember the heroic deeds. We remember the compassion, the decency of our fellow citizens on that terrible day.
Sean Paul Rooney.
Eric Thomas Ropito.
Today again, we are a city that mourns. We come here to honor those that we lost and to remember this day with sorrow. But we also remember with pride. And from that comes our resolve to go forward.
Brock Joel Safranoff.
New York Governor George Pataki, former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, President George Bush, and current New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, along there with a long roll of the 9/11 dead read this year by children who lost relatives in the terrorist attacks. So ends a second anniversary of the country's relationship with 9/11. In a day marked by moments of silence and for many by tears, this evening we will bring you stories of hope and commitment. They come from a unique source, the relatives of 9/11 victims. The extraordinary people you will meet tonight really have transformed their lives in the wake of loss. Tonight on Point, 9/11 families share their visions. 2 years on, later in the hour, we'll be getting to your calls. Did you lose a loved one on 9/11? Has that made you a man or woman with a cause? Has 9/11 reshaped your priorities? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Welcome, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
We're going to hear some incredible stories tonight, and I'd like to dive right in, if I may, Jack. Retired architect and graphic designer Wright Salisbury lost his son-in-law, Ted Hennessy Jr., on September 11th. Ted was heading to California on a business trip when American Airlines Flight 11 crashed into the World Trade Center. He was 35 years old and left behind his wife, Melanie, and two young children. Wright Salisbury then did two extraordinary things. He and his wife, Mimi, picked up and moved to the Boston area to help out their daughter and grandchildren. And then Wright Salisbury took up a cause, the daunting task of building bridges of understanding between Christians, Jews, and Muslims. When we sat down to talk in the WBUR studio, I asked him to first describe his son-in-law, Ted.
Well, Ted was a wonderful young man. He was ambitious and yet a very warm and human and lovely person. I never heard him quarrel with my daughter. My daughter never heard him quarrel with her. They had a perfect marriage, as far as I can tell.
He was 35 on the morning of September 11th, 2001.
That's right.
He'd been married to your daughter, Melanie, for about...
Nearly 10 years.
Nearly 10 years, and they had and have two children.
That's right. Rachel, who is now approaching age 9, and Matthew, who is now approaching age 6.
9/11 really brought a turn in your life. Your response to what happened on that morning, to Ted's death and to so many deaths, was a dramatic one. Describe for us how you took a turn.
Well, a lot of people who were families of victims of September 11th responded in different ways. Mm-hmm. I was on the board of families of September 11th, I then got involved in my own creation, which was the Center for Jewish, Christian, Muslim Understanding, while I was in Westchester County, where I'd lived for 32 years. Then when I moved up here, which we did as soon as we could, I began the Alliance for Jewish, Christian, Muslim Understanding.
So you physically moved, together with your wife, to be near your daughter.
That's right.
And her children, in part, no doubt, to support them against the loss they'd taken.
Well, yes, her in-laws live very close to her, but we felt that she could use the extra support.
So there's the personal cause you took up, but the public cause is in your Alliance for Jewish, Christian, Muslim Understanding. Before you tell us what that group does, tell us why you began it. Why did you focus on religion?
Well, it seemed that religion was one of the two major causes of wars.
The other being on your count?
The other being nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
I personally think that within 100 years, our national identities are going to be very blurred. I think most people will probably speak one language. It'll probably be English, at least as a second language. And nationalism will not be as strong a factor in people's emotional responses to each other as religion is. But as long as religion is here, and I think religion is here to stay, religion has to be understood properly.
Did you blame religion for what happened on September 11th? Did you blame religious fundamentalists? Do you make a distinction?
I blame our national policies in the Middle East, which have been supporting dictators instead of supporting the people. And I blame religion for having responded to that national policy with religious fundamentalism and with violence. If the people who follow religions could get back to the basic core beliefs, they would find that they had a lot more in common than they presently do.
So you've now devoted your life to raising mutual understanding, in this case, between Jews, Christians, and Muslims. How do you do it?
Well, we've had a number of interfaith meetings in which anywhere from maybe 60 to 120 people come. And we state one rule at the beginning, and that is we will not talk about politics, and we will not talk about the Middle East. We're here to talk about religion. And an amazing number of people are interested in coming just to talk about religion and understanding each other better.
And does it lead to a kind of understanding that is an antidote to fundamentalism?
I think it is.
Sitting in groups in North America, far from the Middle East, it's still significant. It still makes a difference.
Well, it doesn't make any difference in the Middle East. But this country is famous for being welcoming to people of all religions. As a matter of fact, the Declaration of Independence says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." They don't mention God. They mention a Creator. They very specifically avoid mentioning any particular religion.
Right, Salisbury, when you sit in a room with Jews and Christians and Muslims and the memory of your son-in-law in mind, do you see mutual understanding there? Do you see antagonism? Is antagonism inevitable in religion?
I don't think it is, but of course I must say that people don't tell me about their antagonisms. People talk to me who believe much as I do, and the people who come to our meetings are probably people who are looking for understanding, not looking for reasons to be angry with each other.
When you look across the world, do you see the possibility of religion diminishing as a source of conflict, or do you fear that we're still headed into greater religious conflict?
Well, I both hope and I fear. I hope that we can learn to understand each other, and I fear that we won't. My hope is that we can is based on the fact that the three Abrahamic religions, all of the three religions that I'm talking about, mm-hmm. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, derive from Abraham, who is not of any religion because he was the father of all the three religions. Mm. And we all claim him as our progenitor. And the basic tenet of all these beliefs are summed up really by what Jesus said, which is, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. The second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the laws and the prophets." This same sentiment can be found in other religions as well. For instance, in the Quran, there's a verse which says, "We believe what has been sent down to us, and we believe that what has been sent down to you, and we believe what has been sent down to you. Our God and your God is one, and to him we submit."
Right, Salisbury, what was your career?
I was an architect and a graphic designer.
You're retired now?
I'm retired.
Did you ever imagine earlier in your life that you might spend your senior years devoted to a cause like this?
I had no idea. I had no intention of doing any such thing.
Has it changed you, this whole experience of 9/11 and its aftermath, as a person, or is it just taken the person you were and put your nose right into these difficult issues?
I think I'm still the same person I was. I think it's hard, a little bit hard on my wife particularly, because I spend so much time doing this. We went to the beach the other day, and she was terribly pleased that we went to the beach, and I enjoyed it very much too, because we hadn't done that.
So you've been really devoted. You've seen a lot over a lifetime, and now this. I've been asking people who have had relatives who died on that day what they've learned from this experience about human nature. I wonder how you respond to that.
I guess I just lived in happy innocence. Objecting to what my government was doing, I thought that they were not handling the Middle East well. I thought they were not handling the Israeli-Palestinian issue well. But I didn't feel I could do anything about it, and I didn't attempt to. And I don't attempt to now either, frankly, because it's just too big. There are a lot of things to do, and you have to concentrate on one thing. And I have chosen to concentrate on trying to create bridges of understanding between Jews, Christians, and Muslims in America.
That seems like a fairly large undertaking in itself, and maybe one that does, in fact, ultimately impact great global policies.
Well, I hope it will.
How's your daughter? How are your grandchildren?
My grandchildren are doing very well. They remember their father. His picture is all over the place. Mm-hmm. They don't get sad about it. I guess there's something resilient about children. They don't do that.
Youth
My daughter
amazing.
Gets very sad, and it's affected her profoundly.
You knew your son-in-law, Ted Hennessy Jr., very well. What do you think you would have made of all this aftermath?
I had a dream about him one time, only one dream. I dreamt that he'd come down from heaven, and he and some others had pitched a kind of little circus tent. And this is typical of the kind of thing he would do if he could come down from heaven. And they were going to put on entertainment for the people down on earth. And I saw my two grandchildren, Matthew and Rachel, and I said, "Oh, your father's in there. Go see him." And so they ran in, and he stooped down with his hands on his knees and said, "My, look how you've grown." It was just what he would do. It's just what he would do.
Sometimes dreams are such a gift. Wright Salisbury, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Wright Salisbury is founder of the Alliance for Jewish Christian Muslim Understanding. His son-in-law, Ted Hennessy Jr., died on board American Airlines Flight 11 on 9/11. Jack, we're going to hear from a number of people tonight who lost relatives on that day and who have turned that loss into energy to pursue a cause, a mission. And here's a man who's already had a full career behind him. He just picked up, and you can imagine it, picked up and moved to where his daughter and his grandkids were to help them out. But that wasn't all. He said, "I'm going to go out and I'm going to bring Jews and Christians and Muslims together." And he's doing it so much that his wife can barely get a day on the beach with him.
Yes, I want to express my sympathy to him and to his daughter-in-law, Melanie, and to Rachel and Matthew for their great loss. But you know, he's making that loss, insofar as one can, meaningful. He's seeing to it that Ted Hennessy Jr. didn't die in vain, that something is going to come out of this. He's changed the course of his life. He's imparting his wisdom. He clearly has a vision of the whole of our history and of the great forces that drive people apart. He's applying that to bring people together and to help them understand one another, to, as it were, change the kinds of things that brought about September 11th. I can't think of a greater monument.
I think of his grandchildren, who must know already, and as they grow up will know, will understand more fully what their grandfather did with his grief, what he turned it into there.
Oh, yes, yes. And, you know, I mean, we all look at tragedy and hope to see the bright side. The loss is there's always something permanently bitter right at the bottom of the cup. It's mm-hmm. just never going to go away. Mm-hmm. But this is something, isn't it? And it's a gift to all of us, and it's a gift that's come out of this terrible thing.
Right. Salisbury's mission. We're talking tonight Hearing the voices of survivors of the 9/11 dead who have changed their own lives in response to that day, you can join the conversation. Did you lose a loved one on 9/11? Has that loss made you a man or a woman with a cause? And what is it? And tell us what you hear in these stories of loss and new commitment. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Leo Arthur Roberts.
And my grandmother, Arcea Castillo. We love you.
And my mother, Deepika Kumar Sapteluri, and I love you, Mom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're hearing tonight from survivors of the 9/11 dead who have changed their own lives in response to the loss of that day. In a little while, we'll invite you into the conversation as well. How did 9/11 reshape your priorities? Did it reshape your priorities? And 2 years on, are you living a 9/10 life or a 9/11 life? We're at 1-800-423-8255. As we opened our eyes on the morning of September 11th, 2001, few of us realized how many goodbyes that day would bring, writes David Portori. David's brother Jim worked on the 95th floor of the North Tower at the World Trade Center and did not make it out alive. In response to his brother's death, David co-founded September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, a nonprofit group dedicated to finding alternatives to war. He spoke with me from New York. I asked him to describe his brother Jim's character.
I'm the youngest of three brothers, so Jim was my oldest brother, and he was an older brother. You know, I remember a lot of things about him. I remember him pushing me on my bicycle when I still had training wheels. I remember him entertaining me and my other brother, Bill, with little sock puppets. He would sort of entertain us with imaginary horse races and stuff like that. And as he got older and I got older, I remember spending a lot of time at the beach with him. He lived out in Long Beach, Long Island, New York. And because we're Italian, we have a lot of memories about meals and food and wine tastings and stuff like that. And he could tell a joke better than just about anybody I know. So those are some of the little things I remember about him, you know, just the human stuff that everybody else has.
And how did you find out about his death 2 years ago today?
That morning, September 11th morning, it just was a phone call from my mom, and she told us to turn on the TV, and we just saw that image like everybody else saw. She had heard from my sister-in-law, and we just watched. You know, I just still remember sitting on the edge of the couch and just watching the second plane hit the tower, watching the first tower fall, watching the second tower fall, watching the Pentagon. And it's really like, it's just like it was yesterday. You know, it's a cliche to say that, but it is just like it was yesterday. And it really took us about 3 days to determine that he wouldn't be showing up somewhere. So by Friday of that week, we pretty much heard how big the hole was and where the plane had hit. It hit the 95th floor of the North Tower, where he worked for Marsh McLennan, and pretty much took out all of their offices and killed about 400 some of their employees. So he was one of them.
David Portori, so many thousands of people were directly affected by the loss of intimate relatives and loved ones on that day, and they've taken so many different paths in the 2 years since then. Can you describe for us the kind of evolution of your own thought in the days and weeks and months after 9/11/2001 and how it brought you to the mission that you've now lashed yourself to in the aftermath of that day?
It certainly comes out of wanting to honor my brother's memory, but it also has to do with honesty and doing things that will be effective in terms of preventing this from happening to other people's brothers, other people's families around the world. And I was really put off by the speed with which we decided to take military action in Afghanistan. I just didn't think it was going to be a very effective way of dealing with the problem. And I think that everybody had exactly the same goals, no matter how they came out on this issue. I think everybody wanted to be safe. Everybody wanted to hold the people who had done this accountable. And I use the term accountability rather than vengeance or judgment on them. I think everybody has to be accountable for their actions. So that's what I wanted. I didn't want to go just spill some blood and probably take some innocent people with them, just like my brother. So it just bothered me when it looked like we were going to have solely a military response. And I did have some mixed feelings about Afghanistan. You know, I might have supported a very, very minor sort of surgical strikes or commando raids, but only if they were in conjunction with much larger efforts in terms of sharing intelligence, diplomatic efforts, rebuilding, reconstruction efforts. And I think what has bothered me most about the administration's response over the past 2 years has been the sole reliance on just military force.
And that reaction on your part ended up leading you to found this group, September 11th, Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. There's a quote from Martin Luther King that name comes from. Can you quote that for us?
He was talking about the Vietnam War in 1967, and he said wars are poor chisels for carving out peaceful tomorrows. And he basically said, how many more dead people are we going to create before we hear their message, which is that war is not going to solve anything, sort of paraphrasing that quote. So I basically hooked up with a bunch of other people who began writing op-eds and editorials in the newspaper and writing letters to the editor. And that's how we came together. And all of us wanted the same thing. We wanted what you might call justice, but without affecting families just like my family on the other side of the world.
And you wanted that enough that you walked away from a career as a TV producer and have committed yourself full time to this peace effort.
Yeah, we've actually been able to make a living at it through individual donations. And what we do basically is we travel all around the country. We've been in about 28 states in the United States, and we've gone to 8 foreign countries. And we've sent delegations of our people to meet with civilians in Afghanistan and Iraq. And just to sort of remind people that even though we have differences, that we're all human beings at heart, and in reality we are all human beings, and that there's got to be a better way of solving this, and that we ought to start working with our strengths rather than working with our weaknesses.
But, of course, military power is always seen as a big one in the United States. If you don't like the war on terrorism approach, what is the approach that Families for Peaceful Tomorrows is championing here?
I would answer it this way. You know, today down at the World Trade Center site, gestures were so important. You know, when I remember my brother, I just think of things he said to me. I think of small things, gestures he made. And today when we went down in that pit, I think of throwing that rose that I had for him on top of that pile of roses. These little gestures to each other, hugging each other, helping each other through that moment of sadness today. And I think we really underestimate the importance of those small gestures relative to these gigantic gestures of military action.
You're saying even in regard to people who may be very alienated from the United States, terrorists?
Yeah, well, you know, look, we're being realistic here. There really are people that want to hurt us, and we do have to seriously deal with them. But I think we cannot abandon the far greater number of people in the world who really love us and want to work with us, but I think, frankly, are just incredibly frustrated and scared of us because we have pushed them away rather than embracing them and saying, look, 99% of the people in the world want the same thing. We want to be safe. We want our kids to be safe. Let's all get together. And then we can isolate that small number of people who really are terrorists and really do need to be dealt with. And if we have to deal with them with some sort of limited military force, you know, let's do it if we have to. But let's not abandon all of the other things we have at our disposal.
David Pitordi, yeah. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
David Pitordi is author of the new book, September 11th, Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. His brother, Jim, worked on the 95th floor of the North Tower of the World Trade Center and died on 9/11. He joined me from New York, where he was participating today, David did, in 9/11 remembrances. Jack there is another man in the prime of his working life who walked away from that career and said, I'm going to make it all about peace. I'm sure that somewhere out there there are relatives of 9/11 dead who went out and joined the Marines.
Yes.
Many people in that cohort with the blow they took wanted to do something. This guy says he's putting his chips with a lifetime of peace work.
Yes, he's transcended all the bitterness, hasn't he, and the hatred. And I even remember when his group, or I think representatives from his group, went to Afghanistan. And remember that? We had some of those people on our show. They were talking to – they were expressing sympathy to Afghans who lost family members to our bombing.
Civilians.
Yeah. You know, the last time I looked at this something called the Iraqi Death Watch, it's a register kept from all the organizations that look at this. There were about 7,000 Iraqi civilians killed in this war. That would be about 100,000 Americans, given the distance in part. So whatever good comes out of Iraq has to be subtracted from it.
A terrible balancing and keeping of ledgers here, wherever you start from. But David Pitordi has kind of planted his flag. And with that quote that from Martin Luther King, wars are poor chisels for making peace. It's a great quote. We're talking tonight with survivors of the 9/11 dead who have changed their own lives in response to that day. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Tell us what you hear in these stories of loss and commitment. 2 years on, are you living a 9/10 life or a 9/11 life? Carrie Lamack's mother, Barbara, was on board the first plane to hit the World Trade Center on 9/11. In the days after the terrorist strike, Carrie Lamack struggled to get through her grief to launch Families of September 11th, the largest organization of survivors of the 9/11 dead. She spoke with me from Framingham, Massachusetts, with her mother's friendly dog, Nabu, at her side. I asked Carrie Lamack how she became involved with other 9/11 families to start the organization.
My sister and I co-founded the group with a couple other people who had lost relatives. And at first it was a way for the families to connect. We realized no one could understand exactly what we were going through, and we wanted to be able to support each other. At the same time, we also realized that there were a lot of issues we had to deal with, and they needed to be dealt with immediately in terms of aviation security, making sure that the aid was efficiently and effectively distributed because Americans were so giving and the rest of the world was so generous. The issues were immense, and we realized that the only way we could handle it was together.
Carrie, that took a lot of presence of mind at a time when people were awfully distraught and confused. How did you actually stand up and say, let's form the organization? What happened?
We actually spoke to a past president of the Pan Am 103 Families Group, and that gentleman gave us some good advice. He said, no one's going to bring you together. You have to do it yourself. And he knew that as victims, we were entitled to information from the FBI since we are victims of an ongoing investigation. Mm-hmm. And he suggested that when we go to that meeting, we get a sign-up sheet and have people give their information to each other since it would be the only time we would all be together.
So you were very brisk, let's get it done kind of people. Was that in the mold of your mom?
Well, that's the way my mom lived her life. If you have an idea, if you have a dream, if you want to get something done, go do it and make sure it gets done well. And I think both my sister and I have hopefully try to embody that as much as we can in her spirit.
I want to ask you about how all that's gone, but let me just ask you very broadly first. What's your sense of how the country has ultimately responded to the families of those who died on 9/11? The immediate outpouring was huge, as deeply heartfelt as it could be. Now we're 2 years on. Is the country, is the world paying proper attention to the families left behind?
First and foremost, you're right. The outpouring that we received from everybody was just immense, and I cannot stress as how grateful the victims' families are. We continue to be amazed at some of the generosity and the kindness of so many strangers, and we thank everyone for that. But at this point, 2 years out, I think that people have to have some courage and the courage to ask questions, because there are a lot of questions that have yet to be answered. We've been put in a position where it has been the victims who have been having to ask those questions, and I think that there has been some more room for support from people outside of the victims' community to help us and to get some answers.
What questions are at the top of your list now?
Well, for example, we fought for 14 months to have an independent commission to study what led up to and happened on September 11th. I think that most members of the public don't understand that there was no overall encompassing investigation. The World Trade Center was never considered a crime scene. Something is very different if for some awful reason someone was to shoot somebody else. The police call it a crime scene and they investigate. For September 11th, that just didn't happen.
Do you think that at this point the American public knows the full story of how and why September 11th happened?
Most definitely not. We did fight for 14 months for a commission. The Bush administration was adamantly opposed against it, which is a question that needs to be asked. Why was that? We finally did get one, thank goodness for some of the senators and congressmen who supported us through it all. And at this point, that commission is underway. It will release its findings, it's mandated to, in May of 2004. Unfortunately, they have not been getting the support from the administration and certain agencies in the government that they need in order to meet that deadline of May 2004. So we're very concerned about that.
Why do you think there hasn't been more cooperation, even more leadership from the Bush administration on digging into how and why this happened?
I would like to be able to ask President Bush that question. Unfortunately, he has not met with the family members other than for photo opportunities, but to actually sit down and ask the tough questions, he's been unwilling to meet with us. We have asked, and we will continue to ask, and many family members have been very involved with the independent commission to make sure that they're asking those tough questions, because every American deserves to know what happened and why in order to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Carrie, it must be hard dealing with all the deep emotions and personal feelings that anybody in your circumstance would have in their interior life here. And at the same time, wrestling with all these huge public issues. I know that you're sitting there right now with your mom's dog, who she left behind, who must be a kind of companion to you at this point. When you step back from this, What have you learned about human nature in this incredible 2 years? You've been right at the heart of the suffering and also the response. How has your view of human nature changed or grown?
My goodness, do we have an hour to discuss this? I think that we've learned a lot. I think that the first and foremost, I've learned that everybody grieves differently and that you have to respect that. I think I've also learned that you can't judge another person's relationship, say, oh, you only lost so-and-so or you only lost so-and-so, because you just don't know the relationship that someone had with a loved one, what that meant to them. I also think that I've learned that, unfortunately, sometimes people don't want to hear about the bad things, even though they may be real. And sometimes people would rather pretend that they don't exist.
You mean that everything's fine, that everything's all wrapped up and lovely?
And that it can't happen to them. And I wish that that was true. Sometimes I wish I was still ignorant in that sense, the way I was before my mom was murdered. Unfortunately, I don't have that luxury now. And we have really tried to make sure that other people aren't in our situation, so they don't have to learn that. But sometimes it has been hard. We have often received hate mail from people who say that we are greedy or that we are worse than Osama bin Laden. That was one of the most difficult to take. So it has been difficult, because being catapults into such a public forum, you get a lot of positive support from people, which we're very grateful for, but you also get some surprising negative reaction.
And how does your mom and your memories of your mom, how do they sit with you now? Is she still a presence in your life, in your work?
She's my mom. She's someone I talk to every single day my whole life, and that can't ever stop. I think that that's probably the thing that's most difficult. Sometimes people say, well, you must feel her with you, and I think that for me personally, I'd actually say, no, I feel that she's not here, and that's the most difficult thing to deal with each day.
Well, respect that and the work that you do. Carrie Lamack, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Carrie Lamack is founder and former president of Families of September 11th. Her mother died on American Airlines Flight 11. Carrie spoke with me from Framingham, Massachusetts. Jack, here, a young person who had this put right in front of her and has stepped up to be the leader of the biggest organization of survivors of victims of that day.
Yes, and what a vibrant personality she is. How you can feel her mother's love in her. She's returning it, not just to her mother, but to this whole, to all of the people who were victimized by this tragedy. And she's standing up. I mean, the idea that anyone would dare send her or any family involved in this something comparing them to Osama bin Laden, that's appalling. And what she said, this, the eloquence of it, the only way we could handle this was together. That could stand for the whole country. She's talking about all of us.
But there is that funny mixed reaction out there. Everyone wants those mourning and left behind in such a symbolic role. Not everyone, but I guess many people want them to stand, to act, to be a certain way, to carry what happened in a certain way. An awful lot of eyebrows raised in the last week with this green light given to potential suits against airlines and the government for 9/11. Yet Carrie was saying that some of the survivors see that as the only way to get leverage to find out what really went on.
Yes, and as she says, it was extraordinary that the Bush administration resisted the inquiry into this. Franklin Roosevelt ordered an inquiry into Pearl Harbor within 12 days of it happening, and there were not one but three of them before the war was out and by the end of the war. That's a political issue, and I believe General Clark, who's going to enter the race next week, is going to make that an issue. What Bush, and Bush in September 11th.
We're talking tonight with survivors of the 9/11 dead who have changed their own lives in response to that day. What do you think? Have Americans lived up to the post-9/11 resolutions to be better citizens, better Americans? Join us. This is On Point.
Joshua M. Rosenblum.
Joshua Allen Rosenthal.
Richard David Rosenthal.
Philip Martin Rosenzweig. Daniel...
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're hearing tonight from survivors of the 9/11 dead who have changed their own lives, taken up a cause in response to that day. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Val's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Val. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I called in because we've been in Madison 2 years, before that Boston and before that New York City. Mm-hmm. And I was struck, touched by the show. I have to say that... my husband lost a friend on that first flight, and I woke up this morning just overall sad. I couldn't quite shake it.
Yeah. I think a lot of us know that feeling. Val, we lost your cell phone's breaking up, but we got the cinema. Are you still there, Val?
I am still here.
You had a friend who got out of the World Trade Center tower.
I did, yes, fortunately.
And you spoke with her today?
I did. I called her to see how they were doing, and she proudly reported that, in fact, while she had been sort of edgy for the past 2 weeks, that today she got through the day nicely, you know, on a relative basis. But I think I consider every day a gift, and certainly September 11th brought that home in a way I wish I'd never experienced. But nonetheless, being out here in the Midwest, many of my friends don't really know how we feel. We on the East Coast, and we with friends who either lost their lives or who live with the tragedy every day. So I just wanted to call in and offer my comments.
Well, it's good to hear from you. I know there were people in Wisconsin and all over the country who lost relatives as well on that day and have just been as glued in to what happened as anybody else. But we're glad that your friend made it out, and we're glad you heard from her today. Let's hear another bit of tape here from Jay Winnick. Jay Winnick's brother, Glenn, was a corporate lawyer and a volunteer fireman. He died in the South Tower at the World Trade Center. Today, Jay has helped launch an initiative called One Day's Pay to make September 11th a national day of volunteerism. Jay Winnick spoke to me from his hotel room in New York, overlooking the pit at Ground Zero of World Trade Center. I asked what happened to his brother on September 11th.
My brother, Glenn Winnick, was a partner in the law firm Holland & Knight, which is a large international law firm. Their New York offices are based about a block and a half from Ground Zero. His building was evacuated when the first tower was hit, and Glenn was part of that evacuation and borrowed some medical emergency equipment from workers on the scene and headed down towards the South Tower. Besides being a partner in a law firm, Glenn was a volunteer fireman from Long Island and an EMT for 20 years. And he was certified in building collapse rescue training, so he certainly was well qualified to run down there, and it was certainly his nature to run towards danger.
Does anyone know exactly what happened then?
Not really. His remains were found 6 months later in late March in what had been the lobby area of the South Tower. He was found just steps away from the one policewoman who died, and her name was Moira Smith. And so our speculation is that they were part of the same group in that area of the South Tower evacuating people. I don't think that he got up very high in the building, but was rather working down near the ground level as people were rushing out.
But he was a volunteer fireman who completely volunteered on this day, who was going in when thousands were coming out.
There's no question. In fact, there were about 2,800 people in Glenn's office building, and he is the only one to have perished. Everybody wisely ran the other way. But as is his nature and is the nature of all these wonderful firemen and policemen, they run towards danger because if not them, then who? Glenn did the same thing in 1993 when the Trade Center was attacked.
He must have been an unusual man to be a lawyer in a big international law firm who's also a volunteer fireman and EMT. What led him to that?
I tell people that Glenn was a very, very good lawyer, but his passion, in his heart, he was always a fireman. He started in his teen years and continued all through college and law school and all through his professional career, just fighting fires. And he was the kind of guy who would stop in the middle of the night if somebody had a flat tire along the highway and stop to help them. And he was just a very giving person. And it's in that spirit that an organization like One Day's Pay is born.
One Day's Pay is a group that you have founded. What's its goal?
The group was founded by a gentleman named David Payne, who I've known for 20 years. He and I are in the same industry, and I jumped on board soon after. Its goal is to establish September 11th as a national day of service, charity, and compassion. It's not a fundraising organization. It is rather an initiative to mark September 11th by doing something for the next guy.
So when you say One Day's Pay, you don't mean put cash on the table. You mean offer up a day's service of some
kind.
That's
exactly right. It really is about one day's payment of service, and it's service as defined by each individual. it's up to people to decide for themselves what they're comfortable with, what they're able to do on or about September 11th. If indeed the only thing they can do is contribute money to a charity of their cause, that's fine too. But really, it's about service. It's about doing something good for somebody else.
Jay, how did you personally move from the emotion and loss that came with 9/11 to the point where you were ready, where you wanted to put that energy into a cause like this?
It's a good question, Tom. It takes some doing to move from the horror that you feel with such a tragic loss of a loved one that you are surrounded with memories, reminders of just about every day because of the nature of this particular tragedy. But at some point, you have to move to a place where you get your life back. And for me, I have seen many initiatives that have sprung up as a result of 9/11. This one is one that really grabbed me. This one says, okay, if there's something that really pays tribute to the kind of person my brother was, and so many others around that time, this is it. It's very simple. It's user-friendly. It's accessible. We encourage people to go to our website, which is onedayspay.org, and simply make a non-binding pledge to do something for somebody else.
There was such an outpouring of national support after 9/11. What do you think, Jay, has happened to that wave of commitment? Is it still there?
I'll tell you, I think that people are looking for a way to do something else and need some kind of formal initiative to rally around. If indeed it is collectively recognized as a national day of service, people are going to rally around that.
And do you think that will happen, or is the impulse ebbing away?
I'm very confident that it will happen. I think people are genuinely very good at heart, and it was so natural and evident in those days and months after 9/11. There's no reason why that kind of feeling shouldn't continue, but there does have to be something that people can say, ah, yes, on September 11th, at the very least, on or about that day, I need to do something for somebody else.
Jay, I know you're in New York right now, in fact, at the Hilton there in the lower Manhattan that overlooks Ground Zero. It's right outside your window. That's where your brother was.
It's very.
How do you remember him?
When I think of him, I certainly miss him, and I am extremely proud of him. And I try to live up to the example that he set, and it's a pretty high standard, but it's something worth shooting for. But as I look over Ground Zero as we're speaking now, it's a devastating image and one that doesn't go away very easily. In the background, though, is a beautiful skyline, and it seems that New York is back on its feet in many ways, but I think also very respectful about what this 16-acre or so site is all about.
And over it all, the memory of your brother Glenn and so many others. Jay Winnick, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Jay Winnick helped launch One Day's Pay to promote volunteerism in response to 9/11. His brother Glenn was a lawyer and volunteer fireman who died in the South Tower on 9/11. He spoke with me from his hotel room in New York overlooking Ground Zero. And out of that, Jack, comes One Day's Pay, committed to service, charity, and compassion. Not a bad triplet.
Not a bad triplet at all, and a monument to Glenn Winnick. You know, September 11th was also the day that Jack Welch's latest book was published. I don't mean to beat on him, but he was such a symbol of the 90s. And we have another symbol in Mr. Winnick and the other firemen, symbols of people who aren't actuated by greed, but by devotion, who performed their duty, and who I think gave us a kind of palate-cleansing image of what human beings are capable of. And for that, I am grateful just to see that that's possible.
A man not even on duty who
that's
helped
right.
clear
right.
out his own building
that's
and then
right.
headed south, grabbed some equipment, and headed in to the World Trade Center. That's got to be a symbol for deep volunteerism. It doesn't get any bigger. Jack, you brought a poem along to help us take this night out. Tell us what it is and why you brought it.
Yes, it's Alfred Tennyson's In Memoriam, A-H-H. A-H-H was Arthur Henry Hallam, a dear friend of his who died, and the poem is his memorial to Hallam.
And at one point, the poet says, "I feel it when I sorrow most. 'Tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all." And then he moves to his affirmation at the end. The year, another year has passed. "The year is dying in the night. Ring out wild bells and let him die. Ring out the old, ring in the new. Ring happy bells across the snow. The year is going, let him go. Ring out the false, ring in the true. Ring out the grief that saps the mind for those that here we see no more. Ring out the feud of rich and poor. Ring in redress to all mankind. Ring out a slowly dying cause and ancient forms of party strife. Ring in the nobler modes of life with sweeter manners, purer law. Ring out the want, the care, the sin, the faithless coldness of the times. Ring out my mournful rhymes, but ring the fuller minstrel in. Ring out false pride in place and blood, the civic slander and the spite. Ring in the love of truth and right. Ring in the common love of good. Ring out all shapes of foul disease. Ring out the narrowing lust of gold. Ring out the thousand wars of old. Ring in the thousand years of peace."
Thanks to Tennyson, and thanks to you, Jack, for being with us
tonight.
Thank you. We're closing tonight's program with music from composer Daryl Bodley. His daughter, Diora, was on board United Airlines Flight 93 when it crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, on September 11th. She was 20 years old. Daryl Bodley sat down at the keyboard just days later and wrote this music in her memory. Here is Steps for Peace by Daryl Bodley.
Evelyn Zeminski.
Michael Joseph Zinzi.
Charles A. Zion.
Julie Lynn Zipper.
Salvatore Zizo.
Procopius Paul Zos.
Joseph J. Zuccolo.
Andrew S. Zucker.
Igor Zuckelman.
And my grandma Myrna Yuskolka.
And my
we love you and miss you.
And my father, Procopius Paul Zois. I love you and I miss you.